Sometimes you hear about a life, a story, and it stays with you. A name, maybe, that seems to hold a deeper meaning. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're exploring the absolutely extraordinary life of George Hogg. He was a British journalist, a humanitarian, and his journey through wartime China, well, it left a huge mark.
And we've got some fantastic sources for this. A real mix, actually. Personal accounts from people who knew him, historical interviews giving that wider context, and George Hogg's own writings, which are just fascinating.
You really are.
Together, they give us this nuanced picture, not just of the history, but of the man himself.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack how this one person went from, I guess, a curious traveler to someone so deeply committed, how that shaped his life, his legacy, and hopefully give you a really unique personal window onto World War II in China and the incredible resilience of the Chinese people during that time. So let's start at the beginning. George Hogg, born in Harbinan, went to St. George's School, then Oxford Wadham College. Politics and economics.
Standard enough start, maybe.
Exactly. But what's really key early on is this strong pacifist Quaker philosophy he got from his mother and his aunt Muriel Lester. That really shaped his whole outlook.
And that philosophy, well, it sort of set him on his path, didn't it? He joined his aunt Muriel on a world tour. They hitchhiked across the U.S. before heading off towards Japan.
And then, early 1938, they land in Shanghai. Just try to picture that. The timing is crucial here, just months after the horrors of Nanjing.
Yeah, the context is stark. The Battle of Shanghai had just ended a few months before November 37. It was called the most vicious battle of World War II in that region.
Vicious.
Utter devastation, huge loss of life. So Hogg arrives to see this city, partly occupied by Japanese forces, thousands upon thousands of refugees, Chinese, even Jewish refugees, pouring into the foreign settlements seeking safety.
And this was before Pearl Harbor, right? Before the Japanese moved on the settlement themselves.
Exactly. That came later, after December 41. So for now, the foreign settlements were, relatively speaking, safer zones.
And hovering over all this is the Nanjing Massacre. Hogg gets to Shanghai right after it happened, December 1937. He must have been hearing reports.
Oh, absolutely. Reports of this terrible, terrible event. The killings, the looting, the mass rapes. It's something that, often gets less attention in the West than the war in Europe, perhaps.
Still not fully understood by many.
Right. And there were Westerners there in Nanjing. Journalists, doctors, missionaries who became vital eyewitnesses. They tried to help protect people, get the word out. Their reports did make it to Western papers.
But it's an ongoing effort to ensure that history is properly remembered, you'd say.
I think so, yes. The mission continues.
So Hogg steps into this immediate, brutal reality. He'd only planned for 2 days in Shanghai.
Just 2 days, that was the plan. But seeing the sheer brutality of the Japanese military, he wrote that he resolved to try to help.
And he jumped right in.
Pretty much. Started helping a New Zealand nurse smuggle food, medicine to Chinese communists. Even helped out with some guerrilla raids, apparently.
Wow. So not just observing anymore.
Not at all.
Okay, so after these initial pretty intense experiences, he gets a job. A journalist in Hankou.
Yes. And there he meets Art Steele, an American journalist with the Chicago Tribune. Steele had actually been in Nanjing during the massacre.
So Hogg would have learned a lot from him. First-hand accounts.
Definitely. Hogg then traveled around for about a year, investigating, writing. But then Hankou fell to the Japanese.
And many journalists were kicked out.
They were. But Hogg, he decided he wasn't leaving. He needed to get back into China, deeper in.
And this is where it gets really adventurous, isn't it? This secretive journey.
It really is. He used his British passport, traveled through Japan itself, then Korea, Manchuria, and then gets smuggled into the countryside near Beijing.
Smuggled by who?
By English-speaking students, using sort of secret routes. And that's where he finally connects with Ni Rongjin and his guerrilla forces.
Right. And he stays with them for quite a while.
About a year, traveling with them. And he observed how they interacted with the local people. Very kindly, he noted. He said it was really, really mind-blowing.
Seeing that different side, I suppose, that connection with the people.
Exactly. And just to add a bit more context, he'd actually taken an earlier trip to the Northwest in June 38. His friend Agnes Smedley arranged it.
Agnes Smedley, the American writer.
That's the one. He visited Yan'an, met leaders like Zhu De, Ni Rongsen, the communist leadership. He wrote about it in his book, I See a New China.
I See a New China.
Yeah.
Quite a title, given the circumstances.
It is. He described the Northwest as an ideal place from which to watch New China taking shape. praise the amazing adaptability of the Chinese people.
So after that year with the guerrillas, he shifts gears again.
Yes. He joins the Chinese Industrial Cooperatives, the CIC, in a place called Baoji. And he's really impressed by the founder, Riwi Ali.
Ah, Riwi Ali, the New Zealander, described as tough but very bright.
That sums him up pretty well. Ali started this gung-ho movement, gung-ho meaning work together.
And why was this movement so vital then?
Because China desperately needed its own industry. As we said, the Japanese had destroyed almost all of it near the coast by late 38, and the blockade was tightening.
So they had to build from scratch inland.
Right, and they did. By April 1940, you had something like 3,000 of these little industrial co-ops across 8 provinces, making everything 500 kinds of goods.
And some were literally in caves, these factories in the caves.
Literally. Like the site at Shangliuan in Baoji, it's quite something. They even kept George Hogg's birth certificate there for years. He was so well remembered.
That's incredible. A testament to his connection.
Absolutely. He got his own gung-ho badge, number 114. And a nickname, Yang Mishu, Ocean Secretary.
Ocean Secretary.
Sort of Foreign Secretary, yeah. And that phrase, Ali coined, gung-ho.
Work together.
It eventually entered English, didn't it? Meaning passionate, really enthusiastic.
Which makes you wonder, how did Hogg feel about this work? He seems fully immersed.
He loved it. He called it a very good job, said it combined industry, social work, writing, travel, all things he enjoyed. And he picked up the language quickly, even dialects.
He really identified with the people, didn't he?
Deeply. He wrote he felt very Chinese by now, that his personality had much in common with the non-citified type of young Chinese. It shows that deep identification beyond just being an observer.
Okay, so let's move to the next really significant chapter. Early 1942, he takes on a new role, headmaster.
That's right. A new Bailey school set up in Shuangshipu, which is about 40 miles south of Baoji.
Bailey School.
Yeah.
Named after Joseph Bailey, an American missionary.
Correct. But the name in Chinese, Bailey, also has this lovely meaning. Prepare for the dawn.
Prepare for the dawn. Fitting. And what was the idea behind the school? It wasn't just a standard technical school.
No, not at all. The philosophy was, as Hogg put it, get them young, get them from tough backgrounds. The goal was for these kids to see the school and the CIC movement as their real home, their family.
Building a future for them.
Exactly. Hogg described Shuangshipu itself as this amazing little village. It had modern things like a small power plant, a hospital, but the people were still terribly poor.
And the co-ops were helping there too.
Oh yes, raising living standards. They even wove hundreds of thousands of woolen blankets for the Chinese army in those co-ops.
And this is where something deeply personal happens for Hogg, isn't it? The adoption.
It is a really touching part of his story. He adopted 4 boys there in Shuangshipu.
How did that come about?
He knew their father, who was an early communist. The father was facing a political danger, basically, so he asked George to look after his family.
And George just stepped up.
He did. Referred to them always as my sons. Wrote about how they were becoming very tough and would be a credit to my old age. It just shows that commitment beyond the job.
That's really quite moving.
He seemed to create a real home there. Called it our place in the country, said it was calm, relatively safe from bombing. He wrote funny stories about the boys always coming over to look at the strangely funny foreigner. He taught them English, nursery rhymes.
And they went on to have good lives.
Very successful careers, it seems. An electrical engineer with patents, a mining engineer, an agronomist. That last one, the agronomist, is apparently still alive today. Over 90, still sharp.
Amazing legacy right there. But the war wasn't over. The threat was still there.
Very much so. Even back in 42, Hogg and Riwi Ali were already thinking they might have to move the school. The Japanese were pushing west.
And eventually they had to.
Yes. In November 1944, the Japanese had taken Luoyang several months earlier. The threat was getting closer. So George Hogg and his Bailey schoolboys began this incredible migration.
The journey to Shandan.
To Shandan in Gansu province, 750 miles away. Hogg himself called it the Little Long March.
The Little Long March. And it was incredibly dangerous, wasn't it? He even got arrested.
He did. He was trying to stop the Nationalist Army from press ganging his students, forcing them into service. He stood up to them and got arrested for it. Shows his courage.
So what was this trek actually like? Can you paint a picture for us?
Just imagine. It was winter, the worst winter in many, many years, according to accounts. They were crossing frozen rivers. Sometimes lorries broke through the ice, walking for months over snow-covered mountains.
Wearing what? Proper boots?
Grass sandals, often. Unbelievable hardship. But interestingly, Everywhere they went, every village, they were met with warmth, respect, kindness.
Really? Even strangers?
Yes. It shows how well-known Hogg was by then, how respected he and the Gung-Ho movement were in that region.
Despite everything, they made it. They reached Shandan.
They did. And early 1945, they restarted the school. In some old temples, they converted into workshops, carpentry, steam engines, wool spinning, 60 boys. Hogg wrote about being full of hope for the future.
He must have felt they'd finally reached safety, reached that dawn.
It seemed like it. But then tragedy struck.
Just when things seemed hopeful.
Yes. July 22nd, 1945, George Hogg died. Tetanus.
Tetanus. From what?
From stubbing his toe. A simple injury. Stubbed his toe playing basketball with the boys. Got infected. Tetanus.
Oh, how unbelievably tragic. And the timing.
The timing is just gut-wrenching. Japan announced its surrender less than a month later, August 15th, 1945. He was so close to seeing the peace he'd worked towards.
So close. What was the immediate impact? How did people react to his death?
On his deathbed, apparently, he asked for a pen and paper. Wrote, "My all to the Bailey School." His final thoughts were for them.
His commitment, right to the end.
Absolutely. Riwi Ali wrote this really moving account of the funeral. Hone being carried by the very boys he'd worked with, the boys he'd led on that incredible march. Later, Ali wrote that the boys made a pact they would never refer to Hogg as being dead.
Wow. And his adopted sons.
They trekked out to his grave. This lonely grave on a mountainside.
A place I believe you visited yourself.
Yes. It has a personal connection for me, that image of his grave. It's powerful.
And how is he remembered today, more broadly in China?
His memory is very much alive. Statues, streets named after him, annual events. There was a ceremony for his 110th birthday in Lanzhou just recently, April 2025, and the school itself was reestablished in 1987.
It's striking, isn't it? He only ever saw China during wartime. Yet his book title, I See a New China.
Exactly. He saw past the immediate poverty and suffering and war and destruction, as he put it. He saw the spirit of the people. He saw the potential.
And looking at China now.
Well, the People's Republic, founded in 1949, life expectancy has roughly doubled since Hogg's time, second largest economy in the world. Literacy is near universal.
A huge contrast to when he found his students were total illiterates.
A massive contrast. And I think Hogg's vision that new China was about seeing the people themselves working, striving, building towards that future, even in the midst of chaos.
It really does bring home why he stayed, doesn't it? That humanitarian impulse. Mm-hmm. He felt he had no option.
He did. He felt compelled to help, and ultimately he gave everything. His life for the people of China, it's humbling. His story, this blend of journalism and deep humanitarianism, it's really captured people's hearts.
It truly has.
And, you know, his story also shines a light on something important. China's role in World War II is often overlooked in the West, or at least not fully appreciated.
Definitely.
Understanding someone like George Hogg, his experiences, his sacrifices, it helps build empathy, I think, bridges between people. His dedication resonated so deeply there.
And his story even made it to film.
Yes, The Children of Huangshi. It brings his story to a wider audience. He really did become what his name, Elwin, suggests, a wise friend, a noble friend to China.
George Hogg's life, it's such a powerful reminder. Even the absolute darkest times, one person's compassion, their determination, it can genuinely make a difference. It can light a path.
He didn't just watch from the sidelines. He got involved. He immersed himself. He acted. And because of that, he could truly see that new China taking shape in the spirit of its people.
His legacy isn't just bricks and mortar, the schools or the co-ops. It's bigger than that, isn't it?
I think so. It's about the power of collective effort, about hope, even when things seem hopeless, that unwavering belief in what people can achieve when they work together. Gung-ho.
Well, we hope this deep dive has given you a richer sense of this truly remarkable man and this vital, often difficult period of history, and maybe something to think about. What does it truly mean to see a new world, a new future, trying to emerge even when everything seems like chaos and destruction? And perhaps what's our own role in helping to build it?